Welcome to Design Ops Island Discs, the weekly podcast from Zero Height that navigates the calm waters of Design Ops with your host, me, Luke Murphy. I'm a design advocate at Zero Height, and I'm talking to the best folks in Design Ops to navigate us through what it takes to float Design Ops within your design org. For this week's episode, I'm joined by Brad Frost, who probably needs no introduction, but just in case, Brad is a web designer, speaker, consultant, writer, and musician based out in the States. He's probably best known as the person who came up with the concept of atomic design, as well as the subsequent book, which pretty much popularized the concept of design systems as we know them today. He's also one of the folks who started up Pattern Lab, co-created StyleGuides.io, and co-hosted the fantastic Style Guides podcast with Anna Debenham, as well as many, many, many other things. Today, Brad talks to us about the developer experience of design systems, how to make life easier, the tools and processes that have helped him, and what he sees as the future of design systems and design ops. This one is a slightly longer one than usual, but to be honest, I could have talked to Brad for days. So without further ado, let's set sail. A good place to start with, how did you get into design systems? What was the journey there?
So I worked as a mobile web developer at a New York City-based agency called RGA, and we were working on stuff for Nike and MasterCard and Tiffany and Company and stuff like that, but they were like MDOT sites. And at the time, the iPad was just coming out. And so I was actually helping make iPad.Nike.com. and I was helping create an experience that was meant to go to the desktop website, to this new iPad website, and to not one, but two mobile sites. There was iPhone.Nike.com, and then there was also just an M dot for everybody else.
Oh, wow.
So okay. It's like four different environments, right? But the experience was, how do we actually deliver this single experience to these four different environments?
Yeah.
So we created an experience that was flexible, that was fluid and all of this. And it just happened to sort of get not quite iframed in. It was like native to all of these different environments, but it was indeed a responsive experience. this was before Ethan had written his article about responsive design. So it's kind of on like the tail end of that Ethan wrote this thing and we're like, yeah, that's what we're doing. And it was like a little different because we were kind of shoehorning it into these different buckets, but same deal. So responsive design sort of came out, the iPad came out, iPhone started to get traction. And I just like kind of happened to be positioned in this place where that was kind of explicitly my job, was like creating these mobile web experiences for these new and emerging devices. Just totally dumb luck, right time, right place, I guess. We started to explore this whole sort of responsive web design sort of concept and sort of meeting the needs of all these different sort of devices and stuff like that. Started getting into, well, okay, we could create these flexible experiences. The hard part is it creating a flexible page. It's pieces of the page, right? It's like, navigation's hard, right? How do you do a horizontal navigation on sort of large screens, but then sort of what does that do on smaller screens? And that's what sort of led me down the road. I created a project called This Is Responsive, which was a collection of different patterns for different types of UI and like how these things sort of flow and adapt across the screen resolutions. And so it's like, here's six different patterns for dealing with data tables. Here's six different patterns for dealing with sort of navigation. And it was cool because the community started inventing these patterns and things started to emerge. We kind of throw them on the pile. And so we had this sort of nice pattern library of, here's all these different ways you can sort of handle this stuff. So that was like the first thing of it. It's not about, oh, let's make the homepage responsive. It's like, well, what goes on the homepage and what components in here need sort of special responsive attention? So that was the first, let's like break this down into its more component pieces, because some things just sort of naturally scale on their own, like images and stuff like that. So that was my sort of first voyage in there. And then sort of as time went on, at the time sort of Bootstrap came out and it was this, here's components, you could build pages. And I'm like, yes. Like, that's nice, but it seemed like too coarse of a story. And so what ended up happening, and around this time, I left my agency job and sort of set out on my own. And I'd sort of been sort of like thinking about these things and that sort of core story of it's like, sure, we have components and we could construct pages with them, but it's lacking this sort of nuance. And that's that's kind of where Atomic Design came from, as well as a tool called Pattern Lab, which is a little bit like precursor to Storybook or whatever. Is, you know, it's still around as a project and stuff, but like this is sort of early 2013, I guess, was whenever we created Atomic Design through the lens of a couple of my first freelance projects. We redesigned TechCrunch, the technology blog, and then a US-based entertainment publication called Entertainment Weekly.
Just small projects to get started on, right?
That was it. And big shout out to Josh Clark, who I'm still working with all these years later. He was the one that was like, hey, I have these projects. Like, would you be interested in doing that? And that actually gave me the opportunity to step out into the great unknown and self-employment without the scariness of it. It was like I stepped out into a project. But it was also through that lens that I was able to work with Josh Clark and Dan Mall. And so like as I had this idea for Atomic Design of sort of splitting out components into a more granular and hierarchical sort of fashion, I sort of was working with them to sort of help sort of galvanize these ideas and really put them into practice. But the funny thing was the gig wasn't deliver us a design system. The clients didn't care about that at all. We were like, here's your new site. And they're like, great, that's what we needed. And we're like, oh, and by the way, here's a super thoughtful pattern library that everything is like super spelled out and very standalone and robust and versatile and all this stuff. And they're like, that's nice, trash can. So it took a while. It took a number of years before that started to even be a thing that people started to ask for. So it was like, at the time it was, please help us make our first responsive websites, right? And that was the gig. And it only evolved into this more, oh, hey, we're actually looking for a sturdy component library. You know, design systems wasn't even a name until, I feel like, 2016, 2017, that people were really actively and openly sort of like talking about, we need a design system or something. So
yeah, so I remember the same thing. It's like, used to create little pattern libraries for little websites that I was creating for my clients when I was freelance. And it was always one of those things where they only cared about it when you were like, well, this is going to shave off a week of my sort of dev time. And that's the point where they go, oh, great. And it's like, oh, yeah, do you want me to package this up in a way you can use it in the future? No, don't worry about that. That's fine.
Don't worry about it. I like the sound of that, but yeah, don't bother. Like, we don't know what to do with this thing. Right?
Yeah, they're like,
we're
probably going to redesign it in 6 months anyway, so it's fine. As one of the grandfathers of design systems now. I mean, does that make you feel old?
I am old. I'm fine with that.
I mean, you've worked on so many design systems, especially like really big ones. And I know that you've obviously built loads from the ground up, but you've worked on quite a few where it's like you've come in and they've been established and it's sort of to overhaul them or sort of fix the problems that are involved. And I suppose on this podcast especially, we've been talking to lots of designers. Well, apart from Jerome, you're the first dev to come on the podcast. And so I suppose I just wanted to know what has been, over all of those design systems, sort of the valuable thing that you've learnt when it comes to building or maintaining a design system from that dev perspective. What are the things that like you wish that you could just, when a developer is about to go in on their first design system, to just take them aside and be like, okay, this is going to save you so much time.
There's so many. There's so many. There are so many benefits from a dev perspective. I'm finding that I'm almost a little bit of an outlier in this perspective, but I basically like treat everything as a reusable component from day one. There's sort of other sort of perspectives out there that they're basically like, once you arrive at like the third use case, then that becomes a pattern there. I'm like, that's not how it works. That's not how it works. What ends up happening is by the time the third team needs a thing, you've already sort of hacked the crap out of everything and you have a big mess that you now have to clean up. So it's like my overwhelming sort of perspective and just sort of like operating model is everything is a reusable component. take whatever you're working on as a front-end developer, and if you're having to write markup, if you're having to write styles, if you're having to write presentational JavaScript, how do you write that once and have that be maximally reused forever and ever, amen? Like, it's that, how do you strip it of its context, of its content? How do you make this the most sort of generic, versatile component you can make it? And it's not extra work. It's not extra dev work to make that happen. It's a mental shift more than anything else. Rather than calling it homepage carousel, you call it carousel. Rather than calling it FAQ accordion, you call it accordion. These sound like dumb ideas, but like, holy smokes, you would be very, very surprised. Like, you know, as we go into all these different things, all these different places, and look at these different code bases and libraries and things like that, there's a lot of stuff that should be reusable, agnostic components are instead these one-off-y kind of things. And then there ends up being a bunch of rework or sort of reconciliation amongst all of these things, or like looking over shoulders and then recreating. And it's like, to touch those things, especially once they're powering real products, becomes a big scary mess. Right. So that's why it's like my overwhelming, we'll say, advice to developers is, it's just like, how do you boil any of your front end work down into the cleanest, purest, most reusable, most extensible, most agnostic components possible? And by doing that just right out of the gate, you're going to save yourself a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of agony, and not have to go this whole sort of refactoring, change management, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, because I've been in many teams where this has been the case, right? It's always the when I've got time later, or when we're bigger and we've got our shit together. And it's like, actually, if you're not treating everything as a reusable component from day one, you're just creating tech debt. You're creating future tech debt.
There's a Creedence Clearwater Revival song called Someday Never Comes. and it's one of my oft-quoted song lyrics, because and it happens all the time with every team we work with. It's just like, oh, you know, like, we'll address this later. Or like, oh, we would like to do it this way now, but we can't for reasons X, Y, or Z. Like, but we will.
Yeah.
It's like that. I'm sorry to say. Someday never comes.
And I suppose, so in terms of, you know, from a practical point of view as well, I'm curious, I'm sure everybody else is, in terms of like your tooling and workflow, like, I'm really interested in what has made your life easier over the years. What is part of your sort of standard, you know, repertoire these days?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, atomic design is the basis of everything.
But that's not really like a tool.
It's not a tool.
People get at me about this, where they're just like, well, like, how do you structure your code base with atomic design? And I'm like, I don't. It's more a way of thinking about it, and it continues to be really good. So I'd say that 100% on all of my projects since 2013, what I call a front-end workshop environment, is the sort of like bedrock of a design system sort of development environment, I guess. And what these front-end workshop environments are, Storybook is certainly the predominant one now, and that that team has done some amazing work to get it to where it is today, and it's really, really exciting to sort of see all that go. As I mentioned earlier, I created one called Pattern Lab, which turned it into a big community. Other sort of developers helped develop that software. That one's sort of more conducive for things like Twig and less modern JavaScript frameworks, and then Storybook is more conducive for React, Vue, Angular, web components, and things like that. As more things have been sort of going in that direction, Storybook has become the sort of de facto leader in this front-end workshop environment. But what these front-end workshop environments do is give you the ability to sort of build UI code in isolation. And that was why I created Pattern Lab all those years ago, was it's like, I don't want to have to spin up a WordPress instance in order to make my buttons orange. Like, I don't need a database to do that. I don't need this stuff. I don't need the data. I just need like sort of a sample of that. All right. And that's the spirit of these things, is like to be able to build UI code in isolation. These front-end workshop environments give you this canvas with which to paint. But not only that, it of course, coming out the other end of it, you have documentation around these things, right? So it's like they do a lot of heavy lifting. And I think what I find in my design system work as I sort of go in and consult with all these organizations is that dev teams treat Storybook as just the documentation part of it. Whereas what we tend to do and what we've been doing since 2013 has been sort of using these front-end workshop environments, not just to sort of document, here's what our buttons look like, here's what our accordions look like, and things like that, but to really play out the whole spectrum of atomic design. Like, here's this low-level button, and here's how that button gets included in this card, and here's how that card gets included in this card grid, and here's how that card grid gets included on the category landing page, and then here's what that category landing page looks like it with women's shoes in there, or men's shoes, or children's shoes, or here's what it looks like when it's on sale, and here's what it looks like whenever this thing is out of stock, or whatever. So what we're able to do is not just design and build these UI components in isolation. We don't do that. We build the components through the lens of real project pages,
wow,
right?
Yeah.
So that's what we do. And like 90%, maybe even 100% of the storybooks and sort of other things that I see like other teams doing just have like the components. And I'm not saying that's like not valuable, but it's like, how do you know that all these components come together to form a cohesive whole? And oftentimes you don't, or there's like a big chasm. It's like, oh, well, we like assemble them all in the product environment. And that's where we really play these things out. That creates too big of a feedback loop between like the low-level UI components and the pages. So what we have is an opportunity to sort of shorten that feedback loop and to sort of co-locate not just the components, but also pages that are built using those components. And then what you're able to do is sort of ship the component library, publish that, you know, as a package or whatever, with a greater deal of confidence. So like fewer things sort of come back into the component library world as like a bug ticket or something, because you're like, oh no, we already took care of what it looks like for a new customer with like an empty state or something like that. It's like you're able to like play all those things out in a very sort of light prototype-y kind of way.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, if you're treating that environment as your full sandbox, it just makes everything like QA easier. And as you said, like I'm guessing also means that you don't end up with that massive chasm between what is in production and what exists in your storybook.
Yeah. What's awesome is that you're able to, as a UI developer, you're able to be like, whenever you get into wiring this thing up in the environment, one, you're able to sort of hand off not just a static Figma comp anymore or whatever, and then like the application developers have to deduce what's going on and recreate that. What you have is this sort of intermediary stage in between a comp and the sort of production code that is a code representation of the comp, but exists outside of the application code base with the business logic and the APIs and the databases and all that good stuff. What you're able to do is have this extra layer of, is this actually a UI bug or is this like an issue? Like whenever we sort of fire it up, you know, or sort of wire it up to this thing, and that's what's causing the sort of performance bottleneck or like the accessibility issue or whatever. By having this kind of prototype, kind of call them interactive comps sometimes, which is just like, here's this thing. It's generally the production, like this is the view layer of your application, like the honest to goodness production, like view layer, right? Yeah. It just doesn't have the data in there.
Yeah.
What you're able to do is have this extra layer of sort of comparison of, let's like, oh, if things are slow, is it slow in the storybook or is it just in the application code base? So like it unlocks like new levels of QA and new levels of like sort of comparison to sort of see like what's going on and why. And I really like that.
I mean, I'm curious though, like it feels like suggesting this as a way to do things would come up against the age old, oh, but we don't have time for that. It obviously will save time in the long run, but I mean, if you were going to estimate, how much extra time would you say it actually takes to do this as a step between just documenting or just building your components and sort of individual patterns in Storybook through to having it all in the production code? I mean, how much extra does it actually take?
Like, negative extra. Negative extra. This is a time saver, not a time adder. And that's with all things design systems, right? This is going to take us so much extra work. And it really isn't. As I was sort of mentioning earlier, it's like by way of just sort of like thinking about things differently, you're not sort of expanding your timelines or your sort of sprints or whatever, like in order to accommodate a lot of the stuff. So much of this is just thinking about things differently. But to come back to your question is, does this take extra time? And the answer is, you have to build the front end UI.
Yeah, you're right.
In order to build the whole product, you need to build the parts of that product, right? So what you're doing is you're just kind of shifting the point of production out of the application environment, which is clunky. You just find yourself tripping up over, again, just sort of like tokens and APIs and all of that stuff. And what you're able to do is oftentimes parallel track these things. So it's like, this has been one of my big soapbox things, has been sort of actually creating a real line and distinction between developers who specialize in UI code, HTML, CSS, and presentational JavaScript. Presentational JavaScript meaning you click on the accordion and it opens. You click on the accordion again and it closes. That's a different kind of JavaScript than writing up some middleware, like sort of doing all this stuff in Firebase and whatever. Not that they're both important. They're both equally important for making a product go. So what we end up having is we sort of, and again, kind of coming back to and like leaning on this, like, does this take longer? It's like what we're doing is we're kind of creating the right swim lanes for people to do their best work.
Yeah.
And so it's like you have like sort of a UI developer that's able to sort of work primarily in Storybook to build the UI code that will power this product. And then you have the application developer who's then freed up to sort of do more of this back of the front end work, as I call it. There's a front of the front end work and back of the front end work. So what we tend to see is people like me, whenever I'm involved in sort of building these design systems with my clients, is me and my team sort of like building that sort of front end code in the sort of Storybook. The application developers are sort of writing all their business logic, doing all their stuff, wiring up the sort of routes, you know, doing all that business. And then we sort of meet in the middle. The meeting in the middle is we publish a library of reusable components that then gets pulled into their development environment, into the app environment. And their yes is a, let me copy and paste, literally, these templates that were created. But we're going to sort of rip out the part where it says page header title equals men's shoes. That's hard coded in there.
Yeah.
And instead, we're going to rip out men's shoes and swap that in with whatever the call is to whatever service that information, that text string is coming from. So it's really just there's no difference in the dev time required to do this. It's you're just adding a little bit more nuance about where that work happens.
Yeah.
So no change whatsoever. But like by splitting it out, you end up with a more elegant workflow that in essence saves time because it prevents front of the front end developers from having to sort of get tripped up and just even standing up their environments. It's like whenever we have to work in a client's dev environment, like for very lousy reasons, honestly, it's like we literally have taken weeks to just sort of get the environment stood up.
Yeah.
And it's like that's just time wasted. Meanwhile, like if we were able to sort of work in this more nimble front end workshop environment, we would have had 2 more weeks of work done. So there is a time savings that comes with this split. It's just a matter of just sort of thinking about where certain work should happen.
Yeah, it's, I mean, one, can you write org design for front-end teams, please?
Yeah, maybe.
I think that's definitely needed. That's the thing, is when you say it, it just makes so much sense. And I feel like it would have saved all of my product teams so much time in the past as well. Where have you been all my life, Brad? So, okay, so you've got how your tooling and workflows work really well and this sort of
sandboxed environment that sort of you work in, what are you missing? Like, what are you waiting for? Is there anything that you're thinking about in the future where you're like, I just wish somebody would build, or I wish I had more time to build this because it would speed up my workflow so much and make everything so much easier?
That's a really good question. I think that there's a few things, and none of it is brand new concepts. Yeah. I think it's just like a matter of sort of like having certain things be a bit more mature. The big one that we've been building design systems with our clients in web components in recent years, and even in the sort of 3 or 4 years we've been building in web components, there's been a lot of improvements and a lot of sort of maturity happen in that world. So I'm very bullish on those. And for the uninitiated, web components are sort of like building reusable components in a native web way. This is like part of the web. This is not a React, Angular, and Vue, Svelte. These are all wonderful, wonderful JavaScript frameworks. They are also proprietary. They are sort of like not part of like the formal sort of web landscape. And web components are especially conducive for these very like low level, dumb, reusable kind of building blocks, just like dumb little blocks of HTML, CSS, and JavaScript that need to sort of travel and like look a certain way and sort of function a certain way. They're sort of contained. And so the web component world is getting better. And so I'd say that that's like one of the things that I am excited about and feel like we kind of like hit up against some edges, I think, a fair amount, sort of how you work with these things and stuff like that. But also there's this opportunity because it's not that web components are going to necessarily replace all of these proprietary frameworks. Each of these things, like the React world and the Angular world and the Vue world, all still very much have a real good place in the ecosystem, especially when it comes to making things work properly. Like state management, the routing, the like all that sort of stuff. Like it's not an either or. I see them as very sort of like there's a good handshake. And we actually have a few client projects right now. What we're doing is we're creating this sort of web component based library that then gets sort of ingested into a React library or an Angular library or sort of some other sort of framework to kind of make it work. To make it work, it's like web components are really good because they could go anywhere because they're just sort of part of the web. You could sort of like launch it onto a WordPress site or whatever in addition to into a React library and then sort of have that go. And it's like pretty awesome. And that sort of gets to the heart of what we're trying to accomplish with design systems is this consistent look and feel, this consistent experience from a user perspective, because your users don't give a crap if this part of the experience is powered by React, but the checkout flow is in Angular and like this other part is sort of like a Drupal site or whatever. Users don't care. They just like want consistent looking buttons.
Yeah.
We finally have a way to make those consistent buttons that can sort of go anywhere. So I'm excited about that. I think that there's going to be like a lot of opportunities coming up. I think that there would be some like really, but again, it's like still a little bit kind of clunky a little bit, the sort of making this all sort of work and get orchestrated together. So there's that. Then on the other end of the spectrum, so that's like sort of squarely in the dev world.
Yeah.
It's like we build web components and then they're sort of like propagating those web components out to other frameworks and environments. That's exciting. That's an area I'm really like bullish on and I'm looking forward to. On the other end, you have the whole sort of split between the design world and the development world. And that is its own beast. And you have tools like Zero Height that are sort of like doing a lot of good to sort of like bridge those worlds together. You have a lot of other sort of tools that, at least on the box or what they proclaim to do, are to try to bring these worlds together. But in my experience, and if you'll allow me, so much of this software and a lot of the tooling around sort of bringing design and development together, or at least like that's what they proclaim, it's actually doing anything but.
Mm-hmm.
We are such big proponents of the best tools of all, which are just communication and collaboration. And what we now have is hundreds of millions of dollars of VC software basically erecting a wall in between the worlds of design and development. And so I think that there's a big opportunity, and it's not that software is inherently evil. Of course, like there's all sorts of opportunities there, but it's like a lot of people are profiting from, oh, the designers are going to stay over here, and then we'll have our like developer handoff button that like sort of does our thing, and then the developers will come in, and it's just like this. Or they could just like talk together, or they could just like, you know, like jump on a Zoom call and like sort of like work through these things. So there's, I think, a lot of opportunity to create a more respectful and more equitable kind of workflows where designers and developers are actually working together, but also getting to this thing that we've been after since the Dreamweaver days and, you know, Adobe Muse and all of this stuff, which is like, what is that sort of split between, you know, can designers sort of like publish things that ultimately go into code? And like, how do we make this a more automatic process? And how do we get our Figma library to just flow into code or vice versa?
Yeah.
And I think that those are really fun and exciting and good things to explore. I remain skeptical, as any developer is, any design solution that says, oh, we push this button and it sort of generates the code.
It's production ready code, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And any developer will tell you, yeah, right, buddy. But there are opportunities to create the right handshakes in between sort of the design and code worlds. Design tokens is like a great example of that, where it's like, you know, these values, I could care less what the hex values are, but like the definitions of those things that I'm pulling into my code, I care very much about.
Yeah.
So it's like design tokens have proven to be an area that we've been really finding a lot of success of, like having our design teams kind of own, like we co-create the design token sort of definitions, the naming conventions. Developers tend to be a little bit more, tend to be better at sort of more like sort of systematic sort of naming and sort of conventions and things like that, whereas designers are like layer 25 copy 42.
Well, it's either or calling the colors like, you know, off eggshell, aubergine or something. It's,
Sure. Sorry, designers, not trying to crap on you, but it is important. Like, designers and developers ought to be naming things the same. They need to be calling things the same. And when you do that, there actually creates this opportunity as the tooling and stuff gets better to actually like have these things like flow into one another. So it's like coming back to just like communication, collaboration. It's like, if we have a button and we have a prop on that button that says variant equals primary or variant equals secondary or variant equals tertiary, in the design world, there ought to be an exact same component with those exact same names.
Yep.
In the Figma world, it's variant, you know, and there's a drop down that says primary, secondary, or tertiary. That's a crude example of, it's like right now that is a manual effort.
Yep.
I am looking forward to the day when this tooling matures enough where it's like, at the very least, these sort of like names can be sort of like stitched together, even if the actual sort of execution or whatever like still needs to happen in parallel tracks. I remain sort of skeptical of like anything that's like sort of automatically, you know, sort of like outputting to one or the other, even like sort of like backfilling things into design tools. There's a huge opportunity there. There's whole startups like built around this. There's loads and loads of different tools that are sort of like meant to sort of like bridge this gap. And I think that there's like a good way to do it. And then there's like the way that I see it right now, which is almost none of it is particularly good. It's a way of keeping designers and developers away from each other. And that that just shouldn't be the case.
I mean, that is the good thing, is that it is, there is an attempt to standardize this, and there is actually an official attempt to standardize this.
Yep.
I mean, with the rate that standardization goes, we may be waiting a while, but I think they've got first draft, so that's good. But yeah, I think it's exactly what you were saying, where it's like, I think everybody who's trying to implement this at the moment, it's at such a basic level that it's like, the idea's great, but there's so much process and workflow that you have to think of and consider to actually stitch it into the way that you'll work in a way that's effective. And it's like, I can't wait for the day. And I think one of the things that's missing there is just, it's what you were talking about. It's the communication piece in the middle. It's like having a system that can sync out both ways and is managed centrally is probably going to be an amazing concept. but
yeah,
the governance and the workflows that are involved to actually make that work in a way that's going to work in any organization, yeah, nobody's nailed that yet.
At the end of the day, the design tooling, the development tooling, all of that stuff is a commodity and will, yeah, increasingly be so. It is the people.
Yeah.
It is,
yeah,
the people part of this. It's like overwhelmingly, and you hear it whenever I get asked these questions a lot, actually a fair amount, was like, oh, what are the tools? Like, how do I keep my Figma library in sync with like my code base? Or like, and it's often framed in this way. How do I get the developers to just like listen to me? Essentially, like you read between the lines, it, yeah, comes in the form of, give me the tool that solves my people problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just doesn't exist. That's a wrong mentality. Software can help for sure, but it's not a panacea. It's not a solve for, yeah, actually sort of getting these sort of teams closer together. And that's why I'm so passionate about sort of coming back to the sort of concept of like front of the front end developers, sort of UI developer, where I'm like, these are people that need to be a peer in the design process.
Yes.
These are,
yeah,
these are designers.
Yeah.
These,
yeah,
are developers who happen to sort of operate in the design team. And probably that's one of my biggest in all of the sort of design system consulting I do is I'm like, you need somebody, and it doesn't have to be like the entire development organization or engineering organization. You just need somebody that can play ball and sort of like collaborate with the designers and sort of translate a design vision into code and bring the code capabilities, right? Bring the realities, the limitations and opportunities of what you can do in the browser to the design process. And so the more that those people are co-located, so you have like a visual designer and a front of the front end developer sort of actually like working together, then you're able to sort of package that work up and ship it as a component library and sort of ship that with confidence.
Yeah.
And so like the developers who are used to, please give me requirements and I will generate code, they can still do their thing. And there's still utility for those people and God bless them. But it's like not everyone can be that kind of developer.
Yeah.
You need to have somebody that's able to go, oh, let me try that out. Or like, oh, like let me push back on like this idea that you're doing in Figma or whatever, because, you know, there's weird source order things going on, or like this isn't feasible. Or, oh, by the way, did you know that CSS Grid could do this, what about that, or what about this sort of like background, like sort of like blend mode or sort of something like that. You need to have that sort of representative from the code side that can actually sort of like make the design stronger.
Yeah.
And when it's this sort of unidirectional, that's why I absolutely bristle every single time I hear the words developer handoff, is that it's just like, no.
Yeah.
And I've worked with loads and loads of really talented designers in my career, and I'm not like sort of trying to disrespect them, but it's like there is a perspective that is necessary in order to really paint a holistic picture of like how feasible a design ought to be. Sure, the like, yeah, visual design matters, the brand matters, the UX matters, but then there's also this, how this actually plays out in the medium which you're launching a product, that also matters as a sanity check, but also, again, as this sort of like opportunity where it's like the design can become stronger when you have someone, a representative from the sort of code world,
yeah,
sort of operating and sort of as a design peer.
Well, yeah.
So, yeah.
It's the same way that an architect and an engineer would work together, right? They understand the medium that they're working with and the constraints that they're working with, and quite often the way that you can actually optimize how you build it and give, you know, advice of like, oh, well, if you change this, then actually it'll work better this way. It's just standard. Yeah. So with all of the companies you worked with, what have been the most sort of like common failings or misunderstandings of how developers work with design systems when you go into a new company and you consult with a new company? Like, and what are, I suppose, what are the ones that you're just like, if you can get this in your mind now, this would make all of my future work much easier?
I think we've hinted around this, I think, a little bit. There's a few things. One is design systems is a very unfortunate name. It's got design in the title.
Yeah.
And so very often it's like whenever we duck our heads into a lot of organizations. It's like the design team takes the lead and the organization understands this as a thing that the designers are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then like the engineers will sort of like receive that, I guess, versus what we were just talking
yeah.
about, which is like, no, like maybe even more so, the engineering organization needs to be fully on board with this. It's like a design system is absolutely part of the engineering landscape. So
yeah.
that's one is like, and again, the name doesn't lend itself to being like, this is a thing that developers need to own and tend to and care about and whatever. So that tends to be a common sort of thing where it's like there's, and again, it sort of gets into like what we've done in certain places is like, the engineering organization really isn't set up very well for this kind of front of the front end role.
Mm.
And so what ends up happening is that the design end of the organization tends to, or can, we've done this a number of times where it's like, yep, looks like you're hiring a few developers like as part of your team. And then that's,
yeah.
that becomes the sort of way to solve that. So the engineering side, not fully understanding or embracing what a design system is, that's one thing that tends to be a common issue we see. Another common issue that we see is components being built in isolation and sort of coming back to this point of it's just like, oh, well, like how much extra time does this cost? And like so many places, they're just like, if we could only just like stop our work and like go off to the side and build this reusable
yeah.
set of components and then come back and sort of pick back up on that. And it's like, again, that's a lovely thought. Like, good luck making that happen. Like, it's like, hey, you know, business, like, you know how we have all these things that we're trying to get done? Like, we want to sort of stop on all of that. So this is, again, sort of why all these years later, I find atomic design to be such a powerful and important concept. Mm. Because what you're actually doing is you're going, hey, you know that mission critical project we need to get done by Q1? Like that checkout redesign or whatever, and replatforming or whatever. We're going to do that, and we're going to build our design system out of that, right? And then we're going to sort of like, you know, that next thing that needs to happen by next Christmas? We're going to do that, and we're going to build all of those pages, and we're going to sort of build and bolster the design system through that work.
Yeah.
So it's like that. It was one of the biggest things that we see is like a lot of efforts to sort of be like, we have a design system, and like here's like a link to our storybook, and it's got like 5 or 6 components, and they're kind of like cherry picking
yeah.
things out from like their product work and stuff. And it's like, no. Like this needs to be literally one and the same.
Yeah.
Like the way you do your product dev work is how you do your design system work. These are not two separate tracks.
Yeah.
This is like the design system is how you do your development
yeah.
work.
Yeah.
Period. And that's often where we tend to come in as sort of consultants is it's like you have this, but we need to like hitch this thing to your very fast moving wagon that the business actually like cares about, that your users actually care. It's like the design system must be in service of shipping real product.
Mm.
And if it's not doing that, it's a failure. It's a cost center. Like in, whenever design systems become perceived as these cost centers, as it's like, this is just a time sink, this is a resource
yep.
sink, this is an energy sink, it's dead. It's not actually doing the job. And the businesses are right to kill those efforts or be super skeptical about them when it's seen as this, I know we have to do this thing over here, but like we need to like do this other stuff to make our own lives easier. It's like, that's not a good place to be. So that's probably one of the biggest things.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, well, there's a number of things. Lack of a governance model
yeah.
is, I think, another one, which is basically like people perceive the design system as this sort of set in stone kind of thing where it's just like the button is like this. And even if I'm downstream from that button and the comp I'm looking at doesn't have the button in code, doesn't look the way that I need it to look in the code base, the reaction is, well, time to either cut the cord or just hack the crap out of this thing and make it hammer hard enough to fit this square peg
yep.
into a round hole,
yep.
right? And so one of the biggest things that we tend to do is really help sort of formalize and establish that feedback loop between what the products need and what the system provides.
Yep.
And the sooner you could create that healthy feedback loop, and this is sort of one of those things where, again, as a consultant, I love this role because it's just like, it's okay for things to be incomplete. It's okay for there to be changes. It's okay for you to sort of like run into the wall of like, we need this thing and this thing doesn't exist. That's natural. That's part of the process. We can address that. We could fill that hole. We could create that new component, that new variation. We could create that new sort of concept. We could solve the problems. We just need to have that feedback loop. So especially in the early days of the system, when there aren't that many sort of solutions in place, there's a deal of trust, and it needs to be sort of this feedback loop established in order to sort of get this thing off the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
And then once it hits like a critical mass of sort of maturity, then it sort of gets into this, oh, okay, this thing has most of what I need. I might sort of run into a few holes or a few sort of blind spots here and there, but by and large, we have what we need. That's what you want to get to.
Yeah.
But like in the early days, when it's like not quite ready for prime time yet, that's whenever a lot of developers will sort of just be like, without that governance process in place, yeah, it's, I don't see this, so therefore, I guess I'm going to go reach for a material designer. I guess I'm going to go just like roll my own, or yeah, I guess I'm just going to sort of like butcher this thing and sort of extend it in like a weird way that sort of doesn't work with the system.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's a developer thing that tends to happen, but it's also a designer thing too.
Well, it's like a
designers
overall
who are
team,
downstream.
Yeah. It's, yeah, yeah. I mean, it is something that always alarms me, the lack of governance and contribution model with design systems. And
yeah,
it's like, and effective ones, ones that aren't just like, oh, well, they can just come to us and tell us what they need.
That's just it. It's like so many teams I work with and talk to, they just kind of like wish,
yeah,
that it just,
yeah,
happens.
It just,
and it's like, no, this actually requires some work,
yeah,
to, and again, it's so much of this, it's less about the tooling or like, we have a GitHub repo, I don't understand why people aren't adding issues to it. It's like, it's not the tools.
Yeah.
It's not like the tools or the mechanics of it. It is like literally the people and the relationships and the relationship building and the trust and the all of that stuff. So it's like, that's the hard work with all of this, is to basically be like, design systems teams are a service organization in service of the product teams,
yeah,
that the design system is serving. So it really becomes this, it's a very humble job, because your job is not to sort of like go, this is how it is. It needs to be, what do you need? How are things going? Are there anything that we could be doing better? Like, have you sort of like run into any like weird spots? Like, can we like have a session? It's like doing that kind of proactive and very kind of like humble, service oriented. Like, we are here to make your lives better.
Wait, Brad, are you suggesting doing like actually talking to your users as a concept? I mean,
weird,
it's strange.
Weird, wild stuff.
I could sit on here for hours and chat to you about this stuff, but I think it's about time that we ship you off to your desert island. Okay, Brad, so you get to take a piece of music, a piece of literature, and a luxury item. So I suppose let's start with the music, because it's obviously the easiest. What music are you going to take with you?
That's very, very hard, actually. Is it one piece of music? Is it like one album?
I mean,
is it?
If you can pick one album.
I'll say Outkast Stankonia.
Ooh.
As an album I could listen to for probably years and years and years.
Yeah.
And have without it sort of going stale.
You, yeah, also get to take a piece of literature. So what would you take to read on the island?
Probably The Element by Sir Ken Robinson.
Oh, okay. Okay, is that,
yeah,
that is that a sci-fi? No.
No.
No,
I don't read fiction. The Element is a book about sort of, I don't want to say it's meaning of life,
yeah,
stuff, but it's meaning of life,
okay,
stuff, sure.
Okay.
It's about like sort of like finding where the element, as he sort of describes it, is like how, where your aptitude meets what you're passionate about. And that's like sort of where people are truly in their element in life, is where it's like, oh, you excel at this thing, you're passionate about it, and you know, one of those things can be true without the other being present. So some people are really good at certain things, but aren't particularly passionate about them. Other people are passionate about things, but you know, never have the skill or know-how. So anyway, so that's a book that's really resonated with me over the years. And I feel like if I'm stuck on an island and thinking about sort of self-improvement and not going crazy, I would sort of enjoy that one. So.
That sounds perfect. And of course, you get one luxury item as well, just to make your days a little easier. So what would the luxury item be?
Either a drum kit or my bass guitar, or both.
Oh, I mean, I actually think that you could get a rig where you could drum.
There we go. My one man band setup.
Yeah, it's perfect. That sounds amazing.
But it is something that I play music every day, and to not be able to do that would be absolute torture. So that would definitely be top of the list.
Brilliant.
Thank you so much to Brad for joining us on Design Ops Island Discs. We're going to leave him making an unholy racket on the island, and who knows, maybe there's a turtle or a lemur that can provide some sweet guitar licks too. You can find Brad at bradfrost.com or follow him on Twitter at bradfrost, although I'm guessing you may already be following him. As always, this podcast is brought to you by Zero Height, the design system documentation platform. You can jump in and create your first style guide for free by heading over to zeroheight.com/podcast. Make sure you add the /podcast bit so you let them know that we sent you. Until next time, bon voyage.